Welcome back to the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. I have someone who's changed my life, and I say that with the most purest love and intentions possible. This man is, I've spoken about him on, I've referenced you so many times on other podcasts, and there's so many accolades you've done of helping clients make over $1 billion in revenue. You've made over 200 yourself. You've impacted hundreds of thousands of people, but you're someone that is a caring person, a genuine person, a high performance coach. You push the limits of human potential through tools and resources and training, and you elevate humanity. And that's not doing you justice. But I just want to say and welcome my guest today, Kuan Ray. Thank you for joining me, my man.
Thanks, Lewis, mate. It's an honor to be here. I feel like with an introduction like that, I should maybe float in, perhaps white.
Yeah. You're levitating right now, aren't you?
Yeah, mate, I'm not even sitting down.
Beautiful, man. Look, for people that have been living under a rock and haven't seen your videos anywhere on any form of social media, what's the elevator pitch for Kuan Ray? How do you introduce yourself these days?
Mate, that's a really interesting question. You know, I guess if you look at what I do, commercially, I help business owners succeed. You know, my jam is really helping businesses scale quickly. But I do it in ways that I wouldn't say necessarily unconventional, but we have a disproportionate amount of focus on performance psychology, because one of the things I've identified is, you know, there's a lot of business process out there. There are thousands of books, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of books on how to grow a business. You know, there are thousands of workshops, webinars, social media posts on the processes of growing your business. But what I've observed is you can give, you know, two people the same information and one will go and make, well, this is what I've discovered. One will go and make tens of millions of dollars with what I give them, but then someone else will fuck it up 52 ways to Friday. And so for me, you know, the thing that we do really differently is we are really good at focusing on the individual and the entrepreneur, the CEO, the owner, the founder, and really supporting them to upgrade, you know, the hardware and the software in an integrated fashion that enables them to do things that they in most cases haven't been able to do up until, you know, us crossing paths. But when you look at what I do at a broader context, I just like to help people. You know, one of the things I'm very passionate about is sharing all of my mistakes. But I'm someone who's made a lot of mistakes, who's had a lot of, you know, challenges, personal, professional, psychological, through my own traumas and experiences, and through my pursuit of, you know, betterment, performance, healing. You know, I've learned a couple of things that I share with people, you know, a lot around parenting as well. I seem to share a lot that resonates around parenting, being a parent, that really seem to help a lot of people.
Beautiful, man. Really beautiful. And there's so much substance on so many pillars. I'll do my best to jump down a couple of those rabbit holes today. The first one that comes to mind, I actually have stolen this quote off you and I use it all the time now, but you asked something in the event of what's the ultimate martial art? And people say like jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, whatever it may be. And the answer is there is no ultimate martial art. There's only the ultimate martial artist. And he or she knows every single martial art and they pull from it at the right time, at the right place when the time is needed to get the result. And that's how I see healing. That's the mission that I'm on, to heal and raise consciousness. That's what my purpose is. I'd love to know from you along your journey, what's been some of the martial arts or tools that have really served you from a healing personal perspective? And then we'll go into how that translates into a commercial sense.
Yeah, good question. And look, it's not my quote. It's Bruce Lee's. Was interviewed. Someone asked him, you know, what's the ultimate martial art? You know, and Bruce Lee fashion, he's like, there is no ultimate martial art. There is only the ultimate martial artist. Who does, you know, has the capacity to learn multiple different styles and forms, but then integrate them in a way that, you know, is meaningful in every moment of combat, either in a defensive, offensive, you know, whatever way it is required in the moment. And so for me, when we drill into the context of healing, like I've been on a healing journey for a long time, it feels like, and look, I think, you know, healing is one of those words that gets used a lot. It's often used, I think, in a range of different ways. And I don't want to necessarily, you know, throw judgment on how it is used, but healing is a spectrum. It depends on where you are in your life, what season you are in your life and what aspect, you know, because I think oftentimes when people talk about healing, they start with personal development, you know, because they want to learn how to become more motivated, or they want to learn how to achieve their goals, or they want to do something differently. You know, they're here, they want to get here, but there's a gap. And so oftentimes people start with personal development. And then personal development in most cases will lead them to, you know, if you're someone who's a student, you'll start to look behind the personal development and go, okay, what are some of these, I'm seeing patterns of concepts here. And then behind those patterns of concepts in personal development, you start to realize, you know, there are psychological modalities which can be really quite helpful. But then, you know, oftentimes what people will do is they'll move from personal development to, you know, psychotherapeutic development or psychological development, where they may be doing therapy. And I think everybody should do some form of therapy. And therapy is like a relationship. You know, you don't necessarily settle down with the first therapist that you meet. You should find someone where you, you know, you've got a groove. But, you know, in my own journey of, you know, being, I guess, in, you know, in the psychotherapeutic environment, is I identified, like probably many other two, is most of the psychotherapists that I get to know, they're just as fucked up as everybody else, you know, and oftentimes they get into psychotherapy as a way to heal themselves. Much like entrepreneurs, they get into business in many cases because they think they want to make more money. But in most cases, it's because there's something within them that doesn't feel right. They don't feel whole. And, you know, they might feel, you know, a little bit broken. Whereas as you start to grow your business, you start to realize there are things that prevent you from growing your business. And then you start to work on those things within yourself. And inadvertently, you end up developing yourself, you know, working on yourself. And then ultimately, maybe depending on the depth that you go to, healing yourself. And so for me, you know, I've gone through, you know, personal development, psychotherapy. And I think psychotherapy is incredibly powerful, especially as an integrative tool. Because I think sometimes, you know, when you start to move away from psychotherapy or embodiment therapy, I'm a massive fan of embodiment therapy. And embodiment therapy is where you really are working with someone to reconnect with your body. And so it's not so much a mind-based therapy like psychotherapy is, where, you know, you're really looking at narratives and stories and histories and traumas and, you know, really trying to, you know, working with someone who asks you questions in a way that in many cases brings you to your own realizations and understandings of your own origins and why, you know, why things are the way they are. But then when you get into the embodiment aspects of therapy, that's about, you know, really learning how to connect with the body. And realizing that the body is an incredibly powerful tool of reception, but also transmission, that we, you know, if we listen to our body, you know, it gives us incredible insights into things presently, but also things from our past. And also in some cases, things from the future intuitively, you know, if we enable ourselves to connect. And oftentimes what a lot of people don't realize, you know, in the embodiment process, you know, the embodiment process for the most part is learning how to feel what is there and learning how to accept what is there. And when you compare that to, you know, whether it be and I'd even go pre-psychotherapeutic, if you look at personal development is all about trying to create a feeling that you want and avoiding in many cases the feeling that is there. And so that's where sometimes as you start to grow, as you start to do different therapies, you start to realize in some cases there's almost like there's a conflict. And I think if you look at, you know, most forms of personal development, especially NLP. And I think NLP is a really potent modality. And, you know, when you look at the pure NLP from Richard Bandler and John Grinder, you know, they essentially went to the, you know, all of the top modalities of psychology and psychotherapy, and they pulled out all of the most potent processes, you know, and I own every single book that John Grinder and Richard Bandler have ever written. And, you know, they are phenomenal in their understanding and their integration. And, you know, it's like understanding the importance of stress conditioning. Stress conditioning is a really potent concept. And it's really important to understand that there are certain times where we need to know how to regulate the moment in order to be able to stay in that moment and perform. There are other times that where we don't want to be necessarily regulating the moment in order to perform. We need to be actually witnessing the moment, experiencing the moment, and being able to feel what's happening in that moment and not interrupting that moment and trying to go somewhere else because we don't like what we're feeling. And that's why I think, you know, when you start to look at embodiment, you know, isn't always convenient, because sometimes it's not convenient to feel certain emotions at certain times because we might be in the middle of a meeting, you know, we might be in the middle of a sales call, and we, you know, we have a trauma or a wound come up, and it's not necessarily environmentally, you know, appropriate to go, oh, okay, I've just got to do a little emotional process right now. You know, when you're in the middle of a, you know, a pitch for $10 million, $100 million, $50 million, you're in the middle of a, you know, a sales process, with you're in the middle of a coaching process, depending on who you are. And so, you know, there are times where embodiment is really potent, but there's also times where it's not necessarily appropriate. But it's also important to understand that, you know, knowing how to anchor an emotion and trigger an emotion is very helpful, but that is not the way That is not the whole way. And it's like what you're talking about. You know, there are certain things that we pull on. The ultimate martial artist is not the one who can kick to the head every time. It's the one that can, you know, essentially, you know, deliver the blow to wherever the gap is. And when we look at, you know, the healing journey, and we're only at, you know, professional development, psychotherapy, and we're only at the embodiment process so far, now those are three great, incredible, you know, broad tools that have very different applications depending on where you are in your healing journey. And then when you start getting into, you know, and when you look at different forms of psychotherapy, you know, I've done a range of different things within psychotherapy and embodiment therapy to support. I was diagnosed with CPTSD, which is essentially a complex form of PTSD where there's no one single trigger. There are multiple layers of triggers. And so, you know, someone who has what you call traditional PTSD, in most cases, it's related to a sight, a smell, a sound, or a situation. And so, you know, if that sight, sound, smell, or situation is present, it creates an activation, which can, you know, lead to anxiety, panic attack, depression, overwhelm. You know, there's a whole list of menu items that can be triggered as a result of an activation. But when you're in a complex PTSD, you've got multiple traumas, multiple layers, multiple situation circumstances. And so, you know, you're not necessarily waiting for some stimulus. In most forms of complex PTSD, it's just some form of activation of the central nervous system triggers the whole nervous system and away you go. And so I tried personal development and I had a level of, you know, healing, and I tried psychotherapy and I had a level of healing. And I, you know, I went down the embodiment path and I had a level of healing, and I tried, you know, alternative forms of healing, like, you know, neuroemotional technique, which is NET, chiropractics, you know, Reiki, all these different things. But where I really started to get some solid traction is when I started, it was about 2015. It came on my radar. And I can't remember exactly how. I think it was Tim Ferriss and Joe Rogan. We're talking about psychedelic therapy and how it was relating and used to treat PTSD. And so I jumped down that rabbit hole, you know, pretty fast, pretty hard. And I studied for 2 whole years. I studied the environment of MDMA therapy and psychedelic therapy and really pulling on academic literature as much as I possibly could. And there's a great book for anyone who's listening, who's curious. It's called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide by Dr. James Fadiman. And in there, he references hundreds, if not more, of research papers going back to, you know, the early 1950s and 60s of how and when psychedelics were used therapeutically in order to, you know, support healing both psychologically and in many cases physiologically as well. And if you go pre, you know, Fadiman's work as well, or if you go pre Hoffman, you know, who synthesized LSD in 1948, you then start looking at indigenous cultures, and indigenous cultures have been using psychedelics for millennia. You know, when you look at what's present in our environment in Australia, for example, we have probably one of the largest deposits of DMT of any country in the world. When you look at our, you know, our stores of acacia and wattle and all the plants that essentially, you know, have that active ingredient DMT, in South America, for example, DMT is present in a particular vine. And so, you know, in Australia, there were certain indigenous Aboriginal cultures that would tap into the use of psychedelics. You know, in South America, there were certain indigenous cultures. You know, when you look at Native Americans, they were using everything from peyote, mescaline, you know, bufo, toad venom. You know, so psychedelics, and even in alchemic environments from the Middle East, and also Northern Europe, they in many cases were also using breath. Breath work was used as a psychedelic tool, whereby, you know, you are using breath, you are pumping breath. That pumping of the breath creates, you know, enormous levels of disproportionate pressures on the cerebral spinal fluid moving up and down the spine, which essentially then push on the pineal gland and the hypothalamus, which then encourage the pineal gland to release, you know, dimethyltryptamine or DMT, which is the active ingredient, you know, in ayahuasca and one of the most potent psychedelics on the planet. And so when I started, you know, exploring MDMA therapy and psychedelic therapy, you know, I started doing, and again, this isn't recreational, this is therapeutic, LSD, psilocybin, 4-ACO DMT, DMT itself. You know, I use a whole raft, I sat with, you know, a whole raft of different medicines to really, you know, try and heal myself. And I found that, you know, there were certain things that were really helpful, and there were certain things that, you know, were profoundly helpful, but there were also certain things that were really helpful, if not used the right way, could actually create more issues, you know, if not fully understood. And I even had a couple of those experiences where, you know, I had therapeutic experiences that actually created more trauma that I had to then go back and, you know, do some work on.
I hope you guys, if you've never heard Cohen speak, just got a taste of the depth that this man has. That was a fucking phenomenal answer. I would love to go a layer deeper if you're okay going here. What for you, and the context of the question is, I've dealt with clients and friends and just family members that it's like, I'm broken, I can't be fixed. I've tried this, doesn't work, tried this, doesn't work. And they have like, they hold on to the story and they tried the therapy, they tried the NLP, they tried the Tony Robbins event, so whatever. And it's like, they stay in that story and they can't break it, can't fix it, can't heal, can't be healed. If you're okay sharing with you, what was maybe one of, or if you can think of the biggest one, the biggest healing for you, whether like for me, as an example, it was my dad. Dad was definitely my biggest wound, and that's where my biggest core wounds came from, and just feeling hurt, emotional. There's a memory that I've done a lot of healing on, of him physically breaking down a door to hurt my brother when I was home. And that was, I think I was 10 years old at the time. So that was a big one for me as an example. And some, but it's like, I've done, I'm a big fan of Demartini, as you are as well. And I've done some balancing and some healing and some plant medicine journeys on it. So yeah, if you're okay sharing with like, what was a big shift for you, but then how did that then change your reality in a sort of day-to-day life?
Look, I'll probably pull on my most recent experiences. As you know, we've had some discussions. I had my first stroke in 2009, and it was a beautiful experience. Like I had an NDE, big burst of DMT. I had the most incredible insights. It was profound, absolutely profound. Even created an event off the back of the insights that I had, which was called Powder Create, which we're looking to bring back to market next year. But then I had another stroke end of 2021, which was huge. It was a 5x5 in our right hemisphere. It was massive. And that was not pretty. That was not enjoyable. That was not insightful. That was absolutely physically and mentally and environmentally devastating. You know, I had it with my son sitting beside me on a beanbag. And it was terrifying. You know, when I had my first stroke, mate, I was single. I didn't have any kids. You know, I surrendered to the whole process. I was like, you know, if I'm going to die, I'm ready to die. I've lived five lifetimes. You know, I don't mind. But then on this one, I'm sitting beside my son. And so when I realized what was happening, it was quite traumatic. But then when I came out of the stroke, I had heart surgery to close a hole in the heart that was causing the strokes. But then I started to crash. And, you know, I'm someone who spent 30 years building what I would say is probably one of the most prolific and profound and practical psychological toolboxes for deployment in a range of different high stakes situations. You know, I spent 2 weeks in Kiev training with the Ukrainian Special Forces. You know, I spent 2 weeks in San Diego training with the chief weapons instructor from the Navy SEALs. You know, I've done some really hard, hard stuff because I wanted to know, how do you do things that are difficult in really high stress, high stakes situations that most people would crumble and fall apart in? So I thought I had a pretty good toolbox. But when I had the second stroke and I had the heart surgery, I started to go into a physiological and a mental decline. And so I started to experience chronic stress. I started to experience chronic anxiety. And I started to slowly but surely experience chronic depression. And, you know, fast forward, the heart surgery was in November. I was kind of okay then, but then I went into decline. But by February, I was clinically depressed. April, May is when I got diagnosed with major depressive disorder. It was probably around February, March when I started to experience incredible levels of suicidal obsession and suicidal ideation. Now, I really feel for anyone who's listening right now who's either there or been in that space, but I would really encourage people just to hang on for a minute and just listen, because you can get better. But for me, my experience was really quite hard and quite dark, because again, 30 years of building this toolbox, and then I find myself in the situation where I'm chronically stressed, chronically anxious, chronically depressed, and chronically almost every moment of every day when I was by myself, all I was trying to think about is, how do I end it and make sure that, you know, no one finds the body, because I don't want to traumatize somebody else. And so that in itself was quite traumatic for someone who's never had a day of depression in their life. Despite my CPTSD, I'd never had depression. I'd had anxiety, but not chronic. You know, I'd never had a day of depression in my life. I'd never had even a thought of ending my own life, you know, especially as being a dad. But then to find myself in the situation where not one psychological tool in my toolbox that I deployed while I was in this state, nothing worked, nothing. And that was scary, you know, really, really scary, because it's like, you know, having all the cheat codes for you know, the most advanced video game you've ever played, and you're used to getting the high score every time you go through a round, but then all of a sudden all your cheat codes don't work anymore, you know, and you're back to being, you know, let's call it a mere mortal player. And I felt like I was not just a mere mortal player, I felt like I was less than, you know, because I still remember this, Lewis. I'd look around the world and I'd look at people and I'd go, oh, I wish I was that happy. And I just see people on the road and be thinking, oh my God, they look so happy. Gosh, I'd love to be that happy. And so for me, that was really quite profound. And that's when I started to have to look for other things. And at this point, I thought I knew about embodiment and I dabbled in embodiment, but I didn't really fully understand embodiment at the level that I guess I am learning now. And, you know, I ended up I built a team of people around me, and I know not everybody has that luxury, you know, but I've worked very hard for a number of decades to be able to be in the situation that I was in, where I was able to put a team of people around me. And this is where I identified a couple of things. First of all, mainstream centralized medicine was fucking useless, less than fucking useless. In fact, it was less than fuck. It was actually made me worse. You know, I remember sitting down with, you know, a psychiatrist and two different psychotherapists, and all three of them, you know, I was saying to them, am I going to get better? And the only thing they did that helped me, they said, yes, you will get better. And I'm like, you promise? And they're like, well, yes, we promise you get better. And I was like, you guarantee, because if you can't guarantee that I'm going to get better, I'm done, I'm out. And like, yes, you will get better. And I'm like, okay, but have you ever seen anyone this bad? And all three of them, this is the worst part, without even thinking, went, no. And so I remember thinking in that moment, holy shit, they're guaranteeing, they're promising me that I'm going to get better, but they've never seen anyone this bad. And so that's when I went down the path of embodiment. And I was way too mentally compromised to even consider doing psychedelic therapy, you know, at this point, because, you know, I didn't have a mindset that was anywhere near able. It was almost like I'd been through, if we put into context, you know, from February through till December last year, it was like one giant plant journey. Wow. Where I was just being pulled apart constantly. And then this year has been like, since December last year, one giant integration from that experience. Because when I was in that space, when I was in that place, all I could see was the worst of me. It was on high beam, it was on full magnification. All I could think about, I was so obsessively self-critical. And so then I started to go through this embodiment process where I started to feel all the emotions that I felt when I looked at these parts of myself, but also just all of the emotions that were present. And I didn't like what I felt. It's not so much I didn't like what I saw. I didn't like what I felt, Lewis. I didn't like the feeling of feeling bad, because I was the guy that could always feel good. I was always the guy that could do anything regardless of the situation. The whole world could be falling apart, but I was, you know, I was together, I was in control, and I was able to execute. But then I found myself in a situation where, you know, none of those things were available to me, and I was left in this puddle of emotions and this puddle of feeling. And so my hypothesis was, this experience was there by design. Because do you know what's really interesting? Guess what part of the brain I had the stroke in?
Oh, I'm not sure. Frontal lobe.
It was frontal lobe, but guess what part of the brain it was responsible for?
Not sure.
It was a part of the brain responsible for emotional suppression.
Ooh. So it's just...
So that's...
Back to Pandora's box open for you.
Pandora's box fucking annihilated. And then all of a sudden, I can't stop feeling, you know? And so it was almost like I had to sit there, walk, talk, lay. You know, I went through this experience where I could not stop feeling for, you know, months and months and months on end. It was like I had, you know, 40 odd years of backed up unfelt emotions. And this is where I started to understand the metabolic nature of emotions. And this, I think this was really helpful for me, because, and I know I'm going in a number of tangents to answer what would be a pretty basic question, but, you know, I've always been fascinated with many things, but one of the things I'm interested in and been interested in a while is cellular biology and cellular function. And you know, I remember reading a book by Candace Pert, may she rest in peace. She wrote a book called The Molecules of Emotion. And that was a book essentially where she talked about, you know, one of the discoveries that she made, where she identified the receptors in the neurons in the brain that are responsible for emotions are the same shaped receptors that are responsible for docking with the peptides that are created when we ingest intoxicating chemicals or intoxicating substance, alcohol, nicotine, cocaines, barbiturates, you know, you name it. And what's really interesting is when you consider, you go, oh, that sounds really quite bizarre. But when you think about it, it's not really, because, you know, how many times has someone been under the influence of alcohol and done something that they've regretted and only to sober up and gone, oh, fuck, I probably shouldn't have done that. You know, and then I've asked this question of tens of thousands of people now. How many times have you been in a situation where you've had this high intensity emotion and you've done or said something that when you calm down, you went, fuck, I probably shouldn't have done that. Emotions have the same capacity to intoxicate that drugs do. It's just a different spectrum of intoxication, but they also have the same capacity for creating dependency and addiction that alcohol and narcotics. And that's why some people are addicted to feeling sad. Some people are addicted to feeling, you know, happy. Some people are addicted to feeling angry, because, you know, those emotions, full spectrum of different sensations. Angry is a very powerful emotion. It makes you feel incredibly strong. And so for some people, it can make them feel, you know, almost like a warped form of a superhero. For someone who's addicted to be happy, that becomes, oh, happiness is my superpower. It's like, well, you know, it works, but it works with someone who's addicted to being sadness. And in many cases, when we look at, you know, how cells evolve, you know, they split and divide and they evolve based on their environment. And, you know, when you look at a cell structure, a cell membrane, or when you observe it, you know, from a scientific perspective, they have a range of different receptors in there, but depending on their environment, those, as the cell splits and divides, that cell evolves to its environment. And so if that cell is used to receiving lots of sadness peptides or lots of cocaine peptides or lots of alcohol peptides or lots of angry peptides, as that cell splits and divides, it's going to remove other docking stations for, you know, other feelings, other sensations, other substances, and create more docking stations for the peptides, you know, that it's getting bombarded with on a regular basis. But then we've also got to understand that a peptide is a protein. Okay, so every emotion that you experience, it is essentially you experiencing the sensation of your cells metabolizing a protein. Mm. And a protein, as you know from your training environment, it's a food, you know. So emotions become like a source of nutrition, you know, for the cell. And as you know, not all nutrition is equal. No. Yeah, some nutrition is really helpful and some nutrition not so helpful. Not all calories are equal, as they say. But when you start comparing cellular biology to, you know, and you start to wrap your head around that, when you compare it to personal development, psychology, psychotherapy, and maybe even, you know, let's call it the psychedelic experience, because oftentimes when people have a psychedelic experience, they become overwhelmed with emotions that for the most part have been left unfelt. Yeah. In Ayurveda, in Chinese medicine, they talk about how unfelt emotions create blockages within the meridian system. And I always found that really, really interesting. And it wasn't until I was going through this process in my own recovery last year, where I went back to Candace Pert's work. I was going through Chinese medicine and some Ayurveda work at the same time. I was having this influx of unfelt emotions, and I was having my Ayurveda and my Chinese practitioner going, you've got all these emotional blockages. You've just got to feel. And I'm like, I've got this embodiment therapist saying, all right, so what do you feel? And I'm like, I'm fucking sick of feeling this, but all right, I'll do it anyway. But I got to the point where I was fucking sick to death of feeling. But then I had this vision. I was sitting on my lounge outstairs, listening to the ocean one night. The moon was rising, and I had this vision, and I thought of Candace Pert in this vision, and I saw this cell, and I saw this cell with all these little hairs hanging out of it. But these little hairs that were hanging out of it were unmetabolized peptides, because when you look at what a peptide is a metabolite. And what do cells do with metabolites? They metabolize them. But when a cell has an excess of metabolites, what does it do with the excess level of metabolites?
Not sure.
Well, fitness. So let's say you have an excess level of glucose metabolites, glucose in your system. What does the body
store it?
It'll store it. It'll store it for a later date. It's information, right? It's just information that gets stored. You know, we're processing enough information right now. We don't need to process anymore. So we'll store that information for another day. And so what I started to realize was, is when we feel, when the cell starts to feel an emotion, when, you know, when that peptide docks with that cell literally starts to change its behavior. It starts to oscillate either at a higher rate of frequency that represents more of the, what we'd classify positive emotions, which is why when people are quite excited, you know, they move very quickly, they speak very, very fast, or they start to oscillate or vibrate at a very, at a lower rate of frequency, which in many cases is associated with people who move slower, often, you know, feeling sad, they're more somber, you know, more aloof. But what's really interesting when you start to consider it from a blockage perspective, and when you start to compare it to personal development, now we're often told as men, you know, you can't feel sad. Feeling sad is a feminine quality. So if you feel sad, you know, suck it up, princess, and fucking put on your brave face. Or you're told, you know, if you don't like the way you're feeling, you know, do a move, you know, get yourself into a happy state, do a move, do a move, do a move. Now you've anchored that feeling in your body. Now that's helpful if you're in a fucking high stakes situation where you don't have the time to feel. But let's say you're feeling sad. So you've got all these peptides that have been released, like swimming like little sperm, you know, through your bloodstream. They're connecting with all these cells in your body, changing the way those cells are behaving. So your cells are starting to vibrate, letting you go, oh, I don't like how I'm feeling right now. I don't like feeling sad. So you know what? I'm going to do my move. I'm going to focus on something else, or I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do something active that's going to make me feel better. And so then your cells literally start to be bombarded with, let's call it a equal opposite emotion. So let's say you're in the middle of your cells are in the middle of chowing down on sadness. You don't like it. So now you go to Uber Eats and you fucking deliver, you know, a massive buffet of happy peptides. And so what the cells will often do, and this is hypothesis at this stage, but I've had this conversation with a number of people in medicine who think that the hypothesis seems to hold ground, especially when you start correlating it with Ayurveda and Chinese medicine. So your cells are chowing down on sadness. And then halfway through that meal, they stop chowing down because all of a sudden they're now being bombarded with a different peptide. And so they stop metabolizing sadness and they start metabolizing something else. And so let's say you go through, I don't know, 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years of, you know, not allowing the body to metabolize the emotions that are sitting in the cell membrane.
Builds up and builds up.
It builds up and it creates a blockage in the cell's capacity to respirate its environment. And cellular respiration is nothing more than a, you know, a fancy term for, you know, the cell's capacity to receive information and transmit information. Respiration, it's breathing things in, it's taking things out, it's breathing things out, it's pushing things out. And, you know, a cell's job is to evolve to its environment. And, you know, if you've got cells that are blocked and they're evolving as blocked systems, it's going to create bigger blockages where you're storing more emotions. And then something is going to come along where you maybe start doing embodiment processes, you start doing breath work, you maybe engage in some form of psychedelic therapy. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've seen this where someone's doing breath work and the next minute they're sitting up and they're just howling, crying, crying, crying. I don't know why I'm crying. I'm just so sad. It's just like, go with it, feel, feel, feel. And that's what I say to people. I do this with my son. Like whenever he has an emotional experience now, I'm like, buddy, just feel it. Breathe into it and feel it to its edges. You know, it's like a visualization. You know, the cell has edges. Feel it to its edges. Feel the emotion until it's no longer there. Don't feel the emotion until it's no longer convenient to feel it. Feel the emotion until the emotion is gone to the point where you're actually like going, okay, is it there? I can't feel it anymore. And if you engage in that type of an embodiment process, you'll be amazed at how fast you can move through things. Like it really does become a element of adaptive performance. And I know that's not necessarily a therapeutic term perhaps, but one of the things that I've observed is that the sooner you can move through something, you know, the sooner you can become better at whatever it is that you're trying to do, whether as a parent, as a physician, as a coach, you know, as an entrepreneur.
Mate. how do we follow up that question? Is I'm obviously conscious of time. There's a couple
keep going, mate. We'll just keep going until I get a knock at the door.
Fantastic, mate. There's a question that I like to ask my guests, and I'm really curious on your answer to this. What's something that you think about a lot, but you don't get the opportunity to talk about a lot?
I think I've been gifted with without a regulator of not saying the things that I think. I really do say a lot of what I think, But an area that I'm really interested in right now that I spend a lot of time thinking about is mitochondrial function and mitochondrial health and metabolic function. Because, you know, one of the things that I've learned through my experience, you know, with depression, suicidal ideation and tendencies, and all the things that went through that, because not only did I have those experiences, I lost 17 kilos, I looked like a cancer patient, but I've started to really become interested in first principles health, you know, because oftentimes we look at or we talk about first principles health and we talk about it. You know, I still remember sitting down with a practitioner only a couple of months ago and he says, when you think of health, what do you think of? And, you know, I was in a busy space. I just got there. I said, well, you know, the ability to have the energy and the mobility to be able to do what I want. He goes, well, no, that's a side effect of cellular health. And oftentimes we look at cellular health as the pinnacle or the first principle of health. And good cellular health is about, again, cellular respiration and being able to feed the cell and create an environment for the cell where the cell can receive nutrients and receive hydration and receive proteins, but then create an environment where that cell is able to expel waste, expel toxins, you know, expel whatever is within the cell that needs to go out so that it then has room to be able to take in oxygen, nutrients, you know, and everything in between. And so through my curiosity, I stumbled upon a new area of science. It's called quantum biology. And quantum biology, not to be confused with, you know, some aspects of quantum medicine, because quantum medicine is also often referred to as energetic medicine, you know, where people are using bioenergetics, frequency treatments, which is in many ways, you know, I guess a form of quantum medicine, quantum therapy. But I'm interested, or I've become increasingly interested in quantum biology and understanding what is happening at a subcellular, subatomic level that is actually leading to cellular performance and cellular health. And that's when you start getting into the quantum realms within the cell is the mitochondria. And the mitochondria is, you know, often referred to as the energy warehouse or the engine of the cell. And, you know, if you don't have a mitochondria that are able to metabolize information effectively and respirate effectively in order to produce energy, then the cells won't function properly. And then if the cells won't function properly, the cells won't metabolize information, won't be able to metabolize information properly. And so then therefore you'll have damaged cells that are replicating. And, you know, you get too many damaged cells that are replicating. We often refer to that as, you know, dysfunction, disease, or at a later stage of metabolic issue is cancer. And so one of the things I've started to research is just how many modern day diseases are actually linked to metabolic issues. And by metabolic issues, I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, weight gain, although weight gain is a symptom of a metabolic issue. It's a symptom of a thermodynamic inefficiency within the mitochondrial transport chain. And so for me, the more I'm learning about, you know, not just the function of the mitochondria, which I think for the most part is fairly well understood. It's understanding how does the mitochondria work and function from the perspective, you know, because it's not taking in nutrients, it's taking in electrons, you know, it's taking in glucose, it's taking in, you know, very finite subatomic substances. And as a result of that, it's producing a very particular reaction, you know, 36 different ATPs, but it's also illuminating in the process. And when the, you know, what a lot of people probably don't realize is when a mitochondria, you know, takes an electron through the transport chain and it gets to the fifth cytochrome, it's actually producing 30 million volts and illuminates. And it creates, you know, a frequency of light, UVC light, which is actually stronger than our terrestrial sun, which, you know, a lot of people would be probably either unaware of or fascinated to know. But when you now start comparing that to Ayurvedic Chinese medicine or ancient scriptures, you know, what did the very first religion say about man? Or what did the very first, when you go back to a lot of ancient literature, how did they refer to man? They refer to man as a luminous being. We are beings of light. You know, we are made of light. But when you start breaking down ourselves, when you start breaking it down to, again, the mitochondrial level, you start to realize, man, we produce an enormous amount of incredibly powerful light that is then reabsorbed in the body. And that in itself creates charge. And we become this, you know, this enormous, you know, almost like battery that has the capacity to create light, absorb light, and then take that light and store it as energy, and then use that energy in the deployment of, you know, daily function. So that's probably a little snippet, because if I go too deep on that in the time, we'll just start bending noodles.
No, I love it, man. I love your level of depth and your obviously ability to teach it too. It's you changed my life from a leadership energetic. You opened me up to the, I guess, the world of energetics. So I was such a anti-crystal, anti-energy, closed-minded young boy back then. I've got a question that I'd love to know from you. I know you value being a father. I believe it's your highest value from last time. I've heard that.
Right up there.
I believe, I know you believe something similar around life is a mirror. It's always mirroring what's in you, and you'll have a lot of that mirroring or triggering in relationships, but also in parenting. I'm yet to be a parent. I have a couple of animals, but no kids just yet. I'd love to know from you, what's been some of the mirroring, the gifts, the triggers, and the growth that being a father has gifted you with?
Yeah, great question. Certainly in an area that I have an enormous level of interest in. I love being a dad. And I think voids, you know, when we start, one of the things I've observed is oftentimes voids breed values. And my parents separated when I was 6 months old. And so my dad, although there was a level of presence, we weren't really that close for my early childhood. And then he moved overseas, you know, I think when I was about 10 or 11. And so there was a felt absence of a paternal father role. And so when I got the opportunity to be a dad, you know, it was something that I dove into because I wanted to be that which I did not have. But then you get these little beings that come through, and they, as they start to grow, you start to realize, man, they fucking piss you off, don't they? Geez, they push your buttons, and they're just these little humans that are just trying to find their way. But what kids do is they essentially create situations and circumstances that bring up emotions that in many cases relate to experiences that we haven't resolved and integrated from our own life. And that's where being a parent, and it's not that different necessarily from being in an intimate relationship, because we get to this level of intimacy, and that's what intimacy is. Intimacy is where someone gets to know you so well, they get to see all of the things that you don't like about yourself.
I love the analogy of, or I use it, is your relationship, and relationship can also be with kids, but an intimate relationship magnifies the inner work you haven't done yet. And it just brings it to the surface for you to work through if you're conscious and aware enough to do it.
If you're a conscious partner, if you're a conscious parent, it's an incredible opportunity. But oftentimes, you know, a child will act out and the parent will feel an emotion, frustration, anger. And they'll go, you know, and they'll often feel like they have the right to blame the child for the emotion that they're feeling. It's not your child's fault that you're experiencing anger. Okay. It's something within you that perceives something that they've done in a way that triggers an emotional response. There, as parents, we've got a few choices. We can experience that emotion and we can react. And, you know, we can react in the emotion. And that's, you know, a really helpful thing to remember. Our job with emotions is to feel them, not become them. You know, so if we can feel an emotion without becoming the emotion, then we don't engage in things that require, we don't engage in things that create rupture, that create wounds, that require then healing. And with kids, they're so sensitive, you know, and so it's not hard to traumatize a child. Like, it's actually relatively easy, because trauma is a spectrum. You know, for the most part, you know, a child falling over can create a level of trauma. You know, taking a toy away from a child, a lolly away from a child can create a level of trauma. But then you've got, you know, emotional abuse, then you've got physical abuse, then you've got sexual abuse. So as we go up the spectrum of trauma, the effect on the nervous system of the child increases. But if we just play in the range where most people live, it's where we have a child that does things that produces an emotion that we become. So we become angry, we become upset, we become irritated, but then we act from that place. And when we act from that place, it's when we often pass on that wound that we're experiencing. You know, and so then the child learns how to respond, and it adapts to that. It creates a survival mechanism around that. In order to survive your anger, in order to survive your guilt, in order to survive your shame, the child adapts. And most of those adaptive strategies for the child don't actually become an issue, for the most part, until that child reaches an age where, you know, those wounds come to the surface. Because what I've learned from my experience, and this is what you've got to look forward to, is most of our childhood shit doesn't really come up until our 40s and 50s. You know, and I hear this consistently, you know, from other people, and there are loads of great cliche sayings that you can quote in relation to this. But you know, oftentimes it's when we become a parent that all of the wounds that we were given as children start to really come to the surface. And it's not to say that they weren't there. It's not to say that there weren't symptoms of it, but it's when they become really obvious. You know, that's why they talk about the midlife crisis. It's a real thing. And the reason it's a real thing is because all of a sudden you reach this level where you can, all your suppressive techniques no longer work. You know, all of the things that you do for distraction and suppression no longer work. And everything that you've been bottling up just starts to leak out through the cracks in your everyday life. And this is where children give us this profound opportunity to feel. And through the process of feeling, it gives us the profound opportunity to demonstrate feeling, to demonstrate embodiment, and to demonstrate healthy levels of regulation. Because to me, one of the things I've learned about feeling is knowing how to regulate a feeling is really helpful. Knowing how to regulate for the purpose of distraction, not so much. And so it's one thing to experience anger or to feel anger, but then project anger. But it's another thing to feel anger and then just regulate it, breathe it, feel it, and then communicate with your environment. Say, hey, honey, oh, hey, Noah, right now, buddy, I just want you to know I'm feeling a whole bunch of anger coming through. And I want you to know it's not because of you. It's because there's something in me right now that just doesn't feel right. And I'm feeling loads of anger. Can you just give me a minute? Can you just give me some space? Can you hold the space with me? You know, and my son is so used to this process, and not necessarily anger, but so used to the embodiment process whereby, you know, we will have an experience together. And I'll refer to an experience I had a few months ago where, give me 1 second. Hello. So this happened with myself and Noah recently. And this is just one of many experiences and situations where he was experiencing an emotion. And he said, Dad, I'm just feeling angry right now. And I was like, okay, feel it. Where do you feel it? He goes, oh, I feel it in my stomach. I said, okay, let's just sit with it. I said, what do you need me to do? He says, can you just hold me? And so I just held him while he felt anger. But it's interesting, you know, it hasn't always necessarily been that way. Actually, let me start again because I got the memory ass about face. So I was having an experience and he goes, Dad, you're really irritated at me, aren't you? I said, no, I'm not irritated at you. I'm just experiencing irritation. He goes, well, maybe you just need to feel it. Okay. I said, okay. And he's like, where do you feel it? And I said, oh, I can feel it in my chest. He goes, okay, feel it. He goes, do you want me to hold you? And I said, yeah. So he just put his arms around me. And so I just started to cry. And so he just held me and held me. And then he started saying what I say to him, which is, you know, feel it to its edges, Dad, feel it to its edges. And then afterwards he's like, so how do you feel now? I said, I feel so much better. And so now what's really interesting, and you know, that's one example of many times where I've been through that process, but he's seen me go through that process so many times now where he actually will replicate that process. You know, he'll have an experience, which, you know, this has happened at least a couple of times only in the last week, where he'll start to have an emotion. And I'll say, is everything all right, buddy? He goes, oh, I'm just feeling angry. It's not you. I'm just got anger inside me, or I'm just feeling sad. And so I'll sit with him. I'll say, just feel it. Feel it to its edges. Is there anything you need me to do? And he might just say, just hold me and I'll hold him. And then we'll go through the process. And then, you know, in most cases, you know, we can get through an emotion and feel through an emotion. And I'll just encourage him to breathe, you know, within a matter of minutes. And then that, in most cases, just completely removes the requirement for a meltdown.
Yeah.
Because rather than him experiencing an emotion, feeling overwhelmed, and then being judged, blamed, shamed, or guilted for feeling emotion, which often creates confusion for a child, which doesn't help them process, which doesn't help them regulate. You know, if anything, it creates a polarization within them where they feel, you know, overwhelmed, stuck, confused, and they don't know what to do. And it's hard enough being a kid, you know, let alone being a kid and feeling a really big, big, big emotion and not having the tools, you know, to be able to process that emotion. And I think that's, you know, that's for me is the key. My goal with Noah, and it will be with Jonah as well, is to create situations and circumstances where I demonstrate the tools. Or not create, I'll start, take that back. I don't even need to create the situations. The situations come about, but demonstrate through the situations that naturally come about, you know, how to use the tools. And Noah is an incredible example, you know, of kids watching and learning through their environment. Much like our cells adapt to their environment and they start to behave in sync with their environment, so do our kids, you know, and so do we. But oftentimes, you know, if we didn't grow up necessarily in an environment, because I know for me personally, I didn't grow up in an environment where I was shown or demonstrated how to regulate. I grew up in an environment where anger, you know, was a weapon, where sadness was a weapon, where shame, guilt, all those things were weapons. And so as a result, as I started to grow and evolve in my early stage relationships, in early stage intimacy, you know, they were weapons that I used.
Yeah.
It wasn't until you look at the feedback from the situations and you start to calibrate and go, you know, I'd like to do something different. And that's where we get the opportunity to try new things, try new tools.
Mate, you've been so generous with your time. I know I was late to this interview, but you've gone over for me, and I'm really, really grateful for that. And I wanted to say just gratitude for you and thank you for you. I don't know where I'd be if it wasn't for the journey we had together, working with you, being a part of your ecosystem, your coaching, your mentorship, your mastermind. For anyone that's listening to this and you're looking for business mastermind, life growth, spiritual growth, and you like Kerwin's vibe, please check out Kerwin's stuff. KerwinRay.com, Instagram, Facebook, any other places for you, by the way, any other plugs in there?
We're on everything. So yeah, okay. KerwinRay.com, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And mate, you're a gift to this world. Thank you for all the impact you've made on me, on my family, my partner, my impact, my purpose, and everything that we've done. And I just want to say, is there anything, any last message, if this was your final message to share to the world, what would that final message be?
Oh, fuck. Just a
small one.
Look, I think, you know, we're only really here for a minute in the scheme of things. And I think a theme that's coming up for me recently is, you know, depending on what you want to do with your life will determine how you live your life. And if you want to do something big, then it's going to require a lot of big action. And big action doesn't really provide an environment for great work-life balance. And, you know, we live in a world now where everyone is addicted to their comforts and they're addicted to, you know, morning routines and doing the things that make them feel good, versus actually just allowing themselves to feel. So yeah, if you want to do something big, then my advice is surrender to the idea of a work-life balance and realize that the people who have the greatest impact on the world are the ones that probably have the least amount of balance. Doesn't make it right, doesn't make it wrong. It just means that, you know, it just helps you understand perhaps where you are.